This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to Is This Real Life? A Bravo podcast that relates our favorite shows to our own lives and the world around us. I'm your host, Mandy Slutsker. Let's get to it. Hi, everyone. I hope you had a wonderful week. I have an extra special episode for you all today. So I have Melissa Reich on. You all know her as Your Bish Therapist from Instagram and also a podcast by the same title. And we get into so much. I mean, we're talking about psychology, neuropathways, like how people's brains can change when they become famous, why we as viewers have these parasocial relationships with the Bravo celebrities and with podcasters, and, you know, the drama that kind of comes along with some of the podcasting spaces. It's so interesting. And then we get into some of Melissa's thoughts on why some of the Bravo celebrities behave the way that they behave. This was recorded about a week ago because I am currently on vacation. I'm visiting my dad and stepmom and getting together with my brother, sister-in-law, and niece. So I wasn't able to get into the episodes from this week in terms of like Vanderpump Rules and all the housewives. So this is more of like an in-depth look into psychology and Bravo. And I just think you are all going to love it. As always, if you enjoy the podcast, give it a 5-star rating and leave a kind review. And if there's anything you want to share with me, you can reach me on Instagram at Mandy Slutsker. All right, we'll take a quick break and then back with Melissa.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone. I am here with a very special guest today, Melissa Reich. She is known as Your Bish Therapist on Instagram. She's a licensed professional counselor who hosts the Your Bish Therapist podcast, serving clinical interpretations of pop culture. How are you doing today, Melissa?
Hi, Mandy. I am wonderful. And I just want to say thank you so much for having me. I am honored to be here and I'm just really grateful. So thank you for that beautiful introduction.
Oh, you are so sweet. It's nice to meet really like thoughtful, kind people in the space because, you know, there's just like a lot of I enjoy it too, right? Like all the reads and all the shade. But you know, at the end of the day, the people that we watch on these shows are human. And I think that's what makes them so inherently watchable. And one of the things I've always been interested in that you are an expert in is why people behave the way they do, especially based on their personal histories.
Yeah. It is really interesting. And that's ultimately why I started my podcast, because people ask me all the time, they're like, why are you doing this? And some days I'm like, I don't know. because it is so, so hard. There's so much lack of humanity on the internet, so much lack of kindness. I get a lot of trolls and hate and things like that. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I think we all have a general curiosity about, you know, why do people do the things they do? And so if I can do a little bit of good in the world by sharing some clinical concepts and, you know, helping people understand that, you know, being human means being imperfect and infallible and all those things, then, you know, that's what I try to do. So
amazing. Well, I wanted to get started just by asking you a bit more about yourself. So like, you've shared a bit about your journey publicly about starting the Instagram account and like why you stepped away from private practice. And I just wondered if you could talk a bit about like how you got started in this space and why.
Yes, absolutely. Because it was, if you would have told me a few years ago that I would be doing this, I would have told you that you needed to like get some mental health treatment. I would have been like, you're out of your mind. Because I was never a social media person. I do, I really value, you know, for me, therapy is magic and I value the process. And I just think some of what is social media can be inauthentic and that bothers me sometimes. But so ultimately, what got me into this is in 2020, during, so when the pandemic started, I had ovarian cancer when I was 17. And then I've been in remission for that for 25 years, which that makes me feel and sound so old. And then when I was in my 30s, I was diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And then, so I had to start treatment for my second cancer during the pandemic, and it was a absolute blood-soaked nightmare. I mean, truly, it was like, are you joking? This couldn't have happened at any other time. It was so hard. So what happened was, I was in private practice. I, you know, had a wonderful caseload of folks that had been with me for a while, and ultimately, my health just decompensated and I had to start treatment. And then my doctors kind of said, well, didn't kind of, they said, this is a new, this pandemic, we don't know enough about it. You cannot practice right now. You have to stay home. And at that point, I was too sick to even do like a telehealth,
telemedicine,
you know, because, right. And so it was like, I couldn't keep doing what I was doing because I was just like too sick and things like that. So I stepped away from my practice, which was truly devastating. And I swear I still feel guilty about it to this day. And, you know, so long story short, I really stayed in my house for 2 years because I was afraid. And every person, you know, so I see a specialist at Penn Medicine because my CLL is more aggressive than it should be. Like my body is just really weird. And he said, you know, a lot of his patients that he did have with complicated CLL did unfortunately pass away due to the pandemic. So I needed to stay home. But what happened is that kind of led me to a really crippling depression, right? You know, I had lost my practice. I felt guilty about that. I didn't really have a purpose. And so, and then I'm going through cancer treatment. I'm scared for my life. People on the internet are telling me that I should just die, you know, citing survival of the fittest. You know, people like Kelly Dodd made really ignorant comments about like me, we were just disposable, you know? And the reason I share this is because people look at me and they admire me and, you know, I'm smart and I'm intelligent, but I'm human. And sometimes when we believe these things, it really can affect us negatively. So not only was I dealing with a cancer diagnosis and treatment, I was also now dealing with a very, very severe clinical depression. And long story short is that I went to therapy. I had a therapist who I just knew she couldn't help me. One time I was doing telehealth and she was smoking a brisket.
Sorry. That's like not professional, but also hilarious. What, smoking a brisket and you're like talking about being like in despair. She's like, hold on. Sorry, that really caught me off guard.
No, I know. And that's why I share it, because It is so funny. And my therapist and I, we laugh about it all the time. Because I'll be like, you know, was talking to her about how I was truly in despair. She's like, hold on, I am smoking a brisket.
That's incredible. That is
so. And again, I share this because, listen, there are people out there. She wasn't a bad person, but like, clearly that is just insanity. And so I don't care who you are. If you're seeing someone and they do something and you're like, this doesn't seem right to me, use your voice and advocate for yourself and move along. And so I had to have a really hard conversation with her, which she did not take well, to no surprise. And I had to fire her, and I found another therapist, and she's been the most wonderful, amazing person. But through getting to the right person, I did truly 2 years of the most grueling, intense trauma work of my life. And so through that healing, I came across Amy Phillips.
Oh,
so
love her.
Amy Phillips. Yeah. And for those of you, I'm sure most of your audience knows who she is. But for those who don't, she has an amazing podcast called Drama Darling. And she's funny and she does impressions. And she's also just like a great human. So she has a Drama Darling pod. It's a Patreon podcast. And I'm sorry, I'm stepping over my words a bit. But so when I was kind of in this weird moment of healing and figuring out, what am I doing with my life? You know, should I go back to practice? Is my health in a good enough place to do that? Which it kind of wasn't at the time. And so my current therapist, we had talked about, what was I going to do? And so Amy, beautiful, wonderful Amy, she had, do you remember she had a show on Sirius XM called Reality Check?
Yes.
For a long time. So while she was at the end of doing Reality Check and transitioning to her Patreon, I had contacted her. She had asked a question about a psychotropic medication, and just knowing the answer to it, I DM'd her. And so we had this nice DMing relationship. And so this is where my name comes from. Can I curse?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
There are no rules on this podcast.
I don't want to disrespect your rules. So.
Oh, yeah. No, that's kind of you. Yeah. No, I swear.
Sure. Okay. Well, so when I DM'd her, I said, hi, Amy. You know, she used to call herself your bitch wife, which was from an old school episode of Real Housewives of New Jersey. Yes, when Judice called Teresa, you know, here she comes, my bitch wife, right? Mm-hmm. So Amy jokingly called herself that. And when I DM'd her, because I do have like a really great sense of humor, sometimes it's very dark, but you know, that's to be expected. But I DM'd her and I said, you can just call me your bitch therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how your bitch therapist was born. And, you know, so on my handle on Instagram, it's bish. Like everything is bish because, you know, the algorithm wouldn't take kindly to a curse in my handle.
Yeah. They have no problem with, like, you know, feeding children like information on suicide. But but when it comes to like swear words, that's when they step in. Sorry.
Yeah, that's off limits. No. You're listening, and this
not
is one
a big
of the reasons
of,
I adore you, because you're right.
Social media
hypocrisy.
Yeah. Just the companies. They're like, oh, we can't really protect children online. I'm like, great.
Yeah, but don't you dare say the word bitch.
Exactly.
Otherwise, we'll hide your algorithm. No, you're totally right. So it started as truly me. I went on Amy's show one time as like a special guest, and Amy was like, you should be doing this. And I was like, what? No. What are you talking about? Like, I just truly, all I ever wanted to do was be a therapist, and I could never have imagined doing anything else. And she just said, I think you're good at this. You have a knack for it. And, you know, the one thing I'll say is, Amy, this equipment I'm using, she bought it for me.
Oh, wow.
She said, you bought it for me, and she said, you really should do this. She's like, no pressure. But, and I was like, Okay. You know, I truly feel like this for me has been so restorative and healing and has given me a second chance at life. You know, I'm so passionate about therapy that I never thought I'd find something else that I'm as passionate about. And so the fact that I have, I'm just so, every day I wake up, I'm just so grateful. I'm so grateful to folks like you and the audience and just people who have embraced me, and I'm just super grateful.
You know, I've talked a lot on this podcast about how I really came to love Bravo. I'd watched Bravo, right? I casually watched, you know, all of Vanderpump Rules, most of Beverly Hills, but I really came to love it after a really dark time in my life. And I noticed like the same with you, with others, you know, where you just like you're in it, but then like the shows mean so much more when you're in a tough spot. And unlike a lot of other times when you're in a rough situation and you rely on something, once you're better, you don't want to rely on it anymore. But with Bravo, I only loved it more once I was kind of out of the hole. And I'm wondering, like, what do you think it is about this network and these shows that people find them during really rough moments and that bring them so much comfort and joy?
That is such a good question. And again, what I appreciate about you is that's so insightful to really realize and understand that, because you're right. You know, for you and I are great examples of that. So my short answer to that is, when we're going through hard times, for me, and you know, I would love to hear your experience too, but for me, Bravo was, it was a nice distraction.
Yeah.
Right. So when we are feeling immense amounts of pain, you can be the most evolved person in the world. As humans, it's, we need a break. We need a release. We need distraction. We need to put things on a shelf for a minute and prevent ourselves from drowning before we go back to it. So I truly think that's what it is. For a lot of people, it's a nice distraction. And I don't know about for you, but for me, it truly allows me to do what I call perspective taking, which is like, okay, so I have a chronic cancer. There's no cure. I have a million health issues, but it's watching this, sometimes there's this thing in my brain where it's like, well, if people think if they were rich or wealthy or famous or whatever, life would be better. And it's like, no, it wouldn't.
Nope.
That's living proof. You know? So
yeah.
It kind of almost makes us feel better about where we're at, because it's like, well, I'm rich, but like, I'm doing okay.
I'm doing, you know? Okay. And also just look at these people. They have problems too. It's just different problems. But we all have problems.
And that's right. And I think that for me, you know, I've worked with many different folks in different socioeconomic statuses throughout my career. And wealthy people have just as many issues as people who aren't wealthy or, you know, lower socioeconomic status. It's just different stuff. It's the same concept, just it looks and it feels different. And I think ultimately for many of us, for me, it's a little validating. It's validating. It's like, and it allows to do what I call a reframe, which is, you know, when you wake up and you're feeling like you're having a hard day, you're in grief, you're feeling whatever. And it's, you watch these shows and you're like, you know, I'm going to reframe what's happening in my life. I'm doing okay.
Yeah. Oh, you know? I try to do that a lot, and not to diminish my own problems or things going on in my life, but to laugh. I found it really hard to, like, lean on laughter a lot. It's like a huge part of my life is just, I don't know, just finding things funny. And I found Housewives and Vanderpump Rules like so funny. And I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I didn't see them as like humorous before, but I see them as comedies at this point, maybe dramedies, but it's, there's so much that happens and life can be so funny and unusual, especially even at dark moments, right? Everyone has like, you know, what do they call it? The, you know, dark humor but there's gallows humor.
Oh, like a dark coping.
Yeah,
yes,
gallows.
Yes.
That's what I was thinking, the gallows humor. But, you know, mm-hmm. everyone's been in a really crappy situation and been able to laugh mm-hmm. at like the shittiest thing that happened. Like, oh my God, this can't also be happening, you know, and just mm-hmm. taking a moment or something funny that happens at a funeral or dealing with, you know, death or cancer. There are things right. that happen that you can laugh at. And mm-hmm. I don't know, I just was able to find so much more humor in The Housewives during that period. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. and then, you know, I just loved it. I feel like these are my stories. These are my people. I love these people. I appreciate. And as I'm getting older and closer to the age and sometimes the age that many of these people are, it's mm-hmm. it's fun to watch that like your life doesn't end at 40. Your life can sometimes just begin.
Absolutely. So I think there's two important pieces to what you said is that one, it is definitely like, you know, when you go through really dark stuff, I feel I use this example of like people like you and me, when you go through dark stuff, you develop this light that other people who have been in that same dark place can see.
Yes.
And right. And so I think that when we see that in each other and we see that in some of these reality stars, there's a kinship, right? A parasocial kind of, and we'll get to that, a parasocial kinship. But also it is like a telenovela with people that we just like or that we've watched for a long time and we feel that we can relate to. So everything you're saying makes so much sense. And especially for people like us who do have like a very dark sense of humor, because when you really go through stuff, like that's just how it is. Like all of my cancer friends, we just joke about how like we have sometimes we'll say stuff and people are like, what? And it's like, listen, let us just have this, okay? So, but I think that it's like, you see some of the stuff on these shows and it's just it's just a recipe with all the stuff that you said for bringing us a little bit of joy in a dark time in our life.
And I think aging is part of finding humor in aging gracefully, mm-hmm. I guess, is finding humor in things that you would have never found funny when you were younger because you hadn't lived. You know, like,
well, right. And it gives a different perspective, right? When you're seeing now I'm going to be 43. And then I look at some of these people that, you know, the age perspective, right? It does shift things for you.
Totally.
So yes, I love that. Mm-hmm.
So those of us who aren't experts in psychology often like to joke, at least I do, that reality TV and especially like The Real Housewives seems to attract people with personality disorders. And I say that very flippantly and not, you know, necessarily always serious. But thinking more critically about what makes a good reality star, do you believe that there are certain mindsets, not necessarily diagnoses, but like mindsets that people are in that make them better candidates for reality TV?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I appreciate your attention to, you know, staying away from the diagnosis part, because that's a big thing for me.
I diagnosed Rachel Levis and I feel terrible about that, but I think I'm accurate. So,
well, I'm sure you are. But, and it's funny because there are some times where I'm like, I know I have an accurate assessment of this person, but I just like, I cannot say it because I will get sued.
Yeah.
But absolutely, there are personality types that are attracted to these shows. Like, for example, you and I, we both work in helper professions, mm-hmm. but we do it in a way that there's not a lot of like glory in it. And, you know, so there are everything that we do, there are reasons for that. And with these reality stars, I was, you know, looking as I was thinking about preparing for this interview, I was just thinking about like, gee, what stands out about those personalities? And for me, two major things is there's a, and hear me out, because this isn't necessarily bad, but there's a histrionic kind of like dramatic approach to life. Like drama and acting and all of these things, it's an art and it's entertainment. And I think, you know, some of these folks are incredibly talented. So I feel like sometimes reality stars have that performative nature or desire, but they don't have the other components or desire to, like, you know, go be in movies or do this or do that. So it is like its own genre of entertainment, right? So that's one thing. And then number two, I think they just, there's a performative nature, number one. And number two, you have to be really comfortable with attention. Right. I mean, just to be honest, you have to be very interested in attention. And you also, there's this thing that I noticed that a lot of reality TV folks, they don't discern between good or bad attention.
That's fascinating.
They just.
You're so right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is what differentiates people like you and me from people like them, because I get a lot of bad attention, which I don't want. And I could talk about that for days, but these are people who sometimes when we grow up with certain family dynamics and, you know, personalities of our parents, we all have inner children that some needs were met, some needs weren't. And for some folks, some needs were just never met. So as adults, our behaviors are ways to get us the things that we need and deserve, but maybe never got. And a lot of times folks, especially when they haven't worked through unprocessed trauma, I see this a lot in my practice, they don't care if it's good or bad attention, as long as it is attention. Because we all have a very human need, right, for validation and for understanding and empathy. And I think some people on reality TV, they don't care that they're not getting the good stuff and they're only getting the bad stuff. I just don't think they care because it serves something in them, if that makes sense.
Oh, that makes so much sense. And I feel like there are people who are born reality stars and that people that, like, walk into it and kind of find themselves mm-hmm. there and kind of look around like, how did I get here? And a great example on Vanderpump Rules, I would say, is Sheena was born for reality TV. That woman cannot mm-hmm. be anyone other than herself, and no amount mm-hmm. of outside influence changes who she is at her core. Like I said this on the Dumpster Dive podcast a few weeks ago, but I said that when I met her at BravoCon, it was like her entire family. We were at this cocktail reception, and in the middle of it, she sees we're sitting on a couch, and the person next to her had an eyelash problem. Like, part of the fake eyelash was coming off. And she just was like, oh, here, I've got glue. Let me fix this for you. And I had assumed she knew this person, but it was just an attendee at BravoCon whose eyelash was starting to come off. And she's just fixing it because that's just who she is, right? Like, that's who she is at her core. Like, and I loved seeing that because she's just so herself. And I would say someone like Katie Maloney ended up on this show because she was surrounded by people who were like that, like Stassi, meant to be on reality TV.
Yeah.
But Katie, mm-hmm. I don't think ever really sought so much attention. And then all these mm-hmm. years later, she's looking around like, I guess this is my job now. But she's also still good to watch, you know, but there's just, yes. like, I feel like two kinds of people on reality TV. Two people that just find themselves there, like a Julia mm-hmm. Lemagova from Real Housewives of Miami. I feel like she just, like, walked into it. And then there's people who are just, like, Lisa Hochstein. Like, just drama mm-hmm. follows them, and they are kind of born for this. So
stop you and say that is a brilliant observation. And you're absolutely right. And those examples that you gave are absolute perfection, because Katie Maloney, it like, she gives zero fucks, and she's just like, well, I guess this is how I'm making my living now. Like, let me just, like, be industrious and make something of this. But yes, you can tell, like, her and Sheena are two fundamentally different personality types. Sheena would have been doing this whether Vanderpump Rules was a thing or not.
Exactly.
You know, so that is an extremely good point. And I consider myself one of those people who just, like, fell into it. And there's a lot of parts of it that I hate, but I was like, I am not meant to do this, but I'm doing it anyway. So yes, I think that's a really good, that's great.
I love it. So I had told you that I did a previous episode with Chelsea from Oh No Chels, and she's on the I Am the Cute One podcast, and she is a mental health professional as well. And we talked about parasocial relationships that we have with Bravo celebrities, and where we really feel like we know these people. And, you know, I'm wondering if you can speak about how this could be a positive in some ways, like the parasocial relationships, but also, you know, how it's a negative for us, not necessarily for the reality stars, but for us as viewers,
yeah.
Like how we engage with them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a good question, because I thought about this last night and I was just writing notes. There are so many positives and negatives to it, but I think that, and here's the thing that's special about parasocial relationships, like it depends on the person. Like everyone forms those parasocial relationships really differently. Some people really, really, really super encourage them, and some people don't and have less, you know, some people have better boundaries around it than others. But I think the positives of it are it can increase our sense of connection, because human beings, fundamentally, we all need people. We all need to have this sense of connection. And we, you know, we all have different situations with family and friends, and some people are estranged, and, you know, there's a lot of loneliness in the world. So feeling like, and by the way, loneliness is just part of the human condition, right? We all feel lonely sometimes. So I think these parasocial relationships, it promotes this sense of connectivity, but it also promotes this great sense of community, right? So some of these, like some of these pages and podcasts, they have like a group that it really does feel like a wonderful human connection with like-minded people. And the one thing I can tell you about human behavior is that we, in most people, enjoy echo chambers. What I will call an echo chamber of like, well, I think this and I feel this, and I want to be surrounded by 15 million people who think and feel the same way. And then there are those folks like, I thrive on the opposite of echo chamber. I think our differences of opinions and cultures and backgrounds is what makes life really beautiful. So for me, that also, the other side of that coin is a downside. Mm-hmm. Just feeling like, if we have people validating and just spewing these opinions and no one's checking the behavior, right? That is how these parasocial relationships, like with Jeff Lewis Live fans, can kind of get out of control. Because
yes,
people,
he's a perfect example. Oh my, isn't there someone who, I think I met her, I saw her at BravoCon, but who is Jeff Lewis obsessed on Instagram? And like, yeah, she flies around and goes to events, but she has like a bunch of kids and stuff. Like she's got like a whole life in a different like city. And then she, I don't know. Yeah. And I don't know how close she actually is with Jeff, or she just thinks she is. But when you hear the same, mm-hmm, you know, person 5 days a week on the radio, and you see them and you watch them on TV, you kind of feel like you know them.
Right. And the thing that Jeff does, so why we'll continue to go with that example, is that he really promotes that. So for example, this person that you're talking about, you know, they have talked and they have pictures together, and they, you know, Jeff talked about her on the radio, kind of praising her, and, you know, because ultimately she was promoting his stuff, right? But then the danger of that is the other side of the coin when things happen, which a lot of things happened about that. And I'm not sure how much you want to talk about it, but
I don't think I know all the stuff. I just like, I see that there's drama, but I don't know like details, if that makes sense.
Yeah, unfortunately, I know too many details of a lot of things. And I don't know if that's just because as a therapist, I'm inquisitive, or sometimes people come to me, but either way, I do have some inside information. But what I'll say is that when Jeff promotes this sense of you're my chump, you know me, but then that can be dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're not really friends, and you don't really know Jeff. We feel like we know Jeff because he literally has no filter and just spills his guts to everybody. But who he is fundamentally, we don't know. and we're not truly friends of his, but he promotes this whole Trump thing as like, you're my people. But it's like, well, so that can be dangerous because, so the last thing I'll say about this is that it creates a false sense of closeness. And for people who don't have the emotional or cognitive ability to discern the difference, that is how some of these kind of unhealthy behaviors get started, because there really isn't that sort of relationship. So does that make sense? It's like, yeah, that it gets confused in people who aren't healthy enough to discern.
To discern, like, I feel like I know this person and I feel very close to them, but in reality, they don't actually know me. And so I don't need to like go to bat for them all the time online, because why am I doing that? There's no point, you know, like arguing with people about this person's behavior, or, you know, when I talk to them at an event, when I meet them, how I behave with them. You know, I think BravoCon, it's wild how entitled I think a lot of us feel to their attention when we're at BravoCon.
That's exactly right.
And, you know, yes, we pay for it, all that. But I was very struck by Gertie. Me and my friend were in line to get a photo with her, and she had to like step away for a minute and she was crying. And I think it's because people were constantly coming up and telling her their stories of battling with cancer. And it's a lot to take on. And she was like, just finished chemo, was about to finish radiation. You know, it's just a lot. And so, you know, when she did come back and we got a photo with her, I was like, thank you so much for being so open. And I'm sure this is really an overwhelming experience. So, you know, but
that's sweet.
But people just don't. But that's not sweet. That's just like kind of being able to read a room. And it's amazing how many people can't. And, you know, or we're saying, oh, so-and-so wouldn't get a photo with me and they're rude. And I'm like, maybe you caught them when they're literally trying to go to the bathroom. Right. Maybe you caught them when they hadn't eaten anything. Like, they're human too. And it doesn't mean they're a bad person or they're a bitch because they didn't give you the kind of attention that you felt you needed.
But Mandy, here's the thing. I want to give you credit for a minute, because what I need you to understand is what you just said is so beautiful and amazing, to be able to see people's humanity behind the celebrity. And but to that point, that's exactly what I mean in terms of people sometimes don't have that discernment. They don't have, they lack the understanding of humanity, right? That these are people. They're not zoo animals. They're not here to do tricks for us and to let us pet their belly. They're humans who they've worked a 12-hour day, and who knows what they have going on in their personal life. They're exhausted. They probably haven't eaten. And it is like, I imagine, like being a zoo animal.
Oh, 100%.
Right? Yeah. Because people like you and I understand that, it's, you probably validated her more than you know, just by acknowledging that. And you and I look at it like, oh, well, that's human. But most people don't do that. So that's a big
really?
Thing.
I feel, I don't know. It's hard. It's hard to know. I think also, like, there is a self-selecting group that goes to BravoCon that has the amount of disposable income to spend at BravoCon, you know, and they're just so where people are just so focused on like what we're trying to get out of it, you know. And part of what I've put in my feedback to the people who organized BravoCon was, I would love to have those cocktail parties without cameras and phones, because for people who just want to have conversations and the goal isn't just getting a photo. I had so much fun. I got photos with everyone, right? But that wasn't the goal. Like, the goal was to meet them, talk to them, ask them about themselves, learn things. Like, I learned a lot about Dr. Nicole. It turns out she was chief resident back in the day. And like, that's a big deal. Like, I know a lot about medicine, and I'm like, wait, why isn't that discussed on the show? That's like huge. You were chief resident? Like, what? You know, and you still are at that hospital. And because I was asking her, like, how do you get away with the filming schedule? Like, how does your employer make exceptions? And she was like, I've built a lot of you know, goodwill with them because I've been there since residency. They've known me since I was a resident. Right. I was chief resident. Mm-hmm. I've like, you know, built up. I've taken shifts. I've done, you know, all that stuff so that when this opportunity came along, I was like, can I work this many hours instead of that many hours? And is it okay for me to go on TV? And they're kind of like, okay, this is weird, but whatever, do it, you know? But but because it's, I can't imagine most medical professionals getting the okay from their institutions to be on TV. That's why I was just so shocked. Like, how is she able to do this? But anyways, kind of going back to a bit of BravoCon, but the drama that we watch on these shows, I feel like sometimes it's kind of like permeates into us and like relationships between podcasters and relationships between Bravo Instagram accounts. And it's almost like, you know, we saw between the listeners of like Juicy Scoop and Jeff Lewis Live, and they were all mad at each other. And then I've seen a lot of this is something I'm so interested in. A lot of Bravo podcasters seem to not be happy with Nick Vile and the Vile Files and how it's sort of become like a Bravo podcast. Which I find just so interesting. Like, do you feel like you have to be a certain type of fan or a certain type of account or podcast in order to cover this topic? Like, do we feel like we have ownership over this topic? And do you know that kind of thing? So what about this space? Do you feel like attacks this kind of drama? Do you like attracts? And I mean, maybe it exists in other spaces, right? Like if there are podcasters about video games, they probably have their own drama too. But you know, do you have any advice for those of us who like watching the drama but don't want to be part of the drama?
Oh, gosh. I could talk about this for days.
I have so many thoughts on the Nick Vile thing.
I know. It's so... Well, I am curious about your thoughts about that. So, okay. Entering this space for me, I have a lot of inside information. And don't worry, I'm not going to go spilling a bunch of tea because that's just not my personality. But I have talked to and had interactions with a lot of really big accounts and podcasts and things like that. And so for me, the podcast space is no different from any other space in that, you know, any place I've ever worked, there are people that have, you know, are moving from the right morals, values, and ethics. And then there are those who aren't. And that is those are human characteristics that are irrespective of the podcasting industry, right? So all humans, there are going to be people who have, in my opinion, it's a little bit of, trying to think of how to say this judiciously. There's a little bit of envy, I think, with some folks in terms of people are looking out for themselves. And sometimes there are some accounts and some folks that they don't care who they have to step on because they just want to be the top. They want to be the top of the pyramid. And like, I'll tell you this. So I was like in the process of being booked for a couple of like really huge podcasts. And then they found out that I didn't like worship a particular celebrity, and they never talked to me again.
What?
And
how do you even know what's the right celebrity? Like, I just, I find a lot of this very foreign.
Yeah. So, because I'm team accountability. Like, I don't get enamored by celebrity. Like, I see humans as humans. And there are a lot of folks who build their brand on the backs of other people. And they will do what they need to do to get to the top. Now, Nick, how do you say it? Vile?
Vile.
I always say Vile. Okay. I don't know. I get this like anxiety and I don't want to mispronounce someone's name because that's so important. But so I think here's the thing. I've listened to his podcast. He's a good interviewer.
He's so good.
He's so, so good that I find it's like I understand people are frustrated because it's like I think essentially people feel like, well, that should be me. It should be me getting those big Bravo interviews. It should be me. It shouldn't be him. But it's like, if he were, you know, there are people who are better interviewers than other, right? And I just think he's good at what he does. So no, I have no ill will towards him in terms of the stuff that he's covered, because I think that he's good at it and good for him. Like I have, you know, no issues with that. But I think when people look at him and are critical, you know, to me, that's what it is. It's kind of an envy. It's a, why can't this be me? It's a me. I want to grow. I want to grow. You know, we all want to grow, but we have to do it authentically and in a healthy way. Otherwise, it's just stolen valor. But some people don't care if it's stolen valor or not, you know?
That's so interesting. I feel like with the Nick Vile stuff, the things that would frustrate me and that do is when he gets things wrong, like just basic info that any person that watches Bravo regularly would know. Since he's a newer watcher, oh, right. He doesn't know like the history. And so a lot of people feel like yeah. You have to put in the time and the effort to know the history to do a good interview, but he's proving them wrong. Mm-hmm. You don't. I'm learning more about these Bravo celebrities right. And their backgrounds just by the questions he's asking than I've learned anywhere mm-hmm. else. And because he's not trying mm-hmm. to get tea about the shows themselves, right? He's actually pulling out pieces of information that you wouldn't get otherwise. And I find it like that's I've right. never listened to him until recently, and I'm like obsessed with the show, and I really like his fiance. She asks really good probing mm-hmm. questions. I'm like, wow, this is who I want interviewing people, because I'm mm-hmm. thinking some of those questions right before he asks them, you know, to you know, right. anyway, so I find it interesting. At the same time, a lot of people in the space have gotten to the point where they make money off it. This is their job. And mm-hmm. so if someone mm-hmm. else gets that interview, that does mean that like they don't get that. And that does impact right. their bottom line. And you know, if they're trying to live off it, it is competitive. And so that's the part mm-hmm. that separates me, is where it's like, this is not my job. This is something I do for fun. It's a labor of love. It's, mm-hmm. you know, so if people don't like it, and they're like, I don't like that you do this on your podcast, or you have internalized misogyny. Someone told me that once. I was like, okay, you know.
What?
Oh, God. I don't know. Maybe I did in a comment that I said. They didn't give a very good example. You know, but okay. Like, okay, I'm not going to change and bend and flip to try and like fit some mold so that more people listen to me. Mm-hmm. And that makes it a lot right. easier to do the podcast, because I don't have to think about what people want, because I truthfully right. don't care. I just produce what I make. And if people like it, they like it. If they don't, they don't. But, right. you know,
right. I truly think
to like figure out whatever, right. way, you know,
because this is not your right. And so, but I think to your point, that is what makes you really great. And you are a good interviewer. Like you sent me the list of questions you sent me. Like I've gone on, you know, other podcasts and things like that. Like you really are good at this. You're a good interviewer. You ask very thoughtful questions. You have good insight. So like, you can just tell that you move from a place of like, you can tell when people move from a place of I'm really trying to make money and make this a thing, that it's like they're trying to make fetch happen.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, there's something about that that feels icky and disingenuous and stuff like that. So I think that you can tell the difference. And the thing that I do like about Nick, and I understand those criticisms, but like, podcasters, we get criticized for everything. I'll make one little misstep.
I know.
About like, I called like Sounds of Freedom. I said it was like a documentary instead of like what it was. And people destroyed me online. And I was like, hi, I'm a person. I made a mistake. Like, I'm not perfect. So with Nick, sometimes not. Could he have more Bravo knowledge? Well, sure. But like, he's also just like doing his job and being a good interviewer and asking thoughtful questions that, to me, he doesn't need to be like a fan from day one, episode one. You know, I think sometimes fans also look at that and they say, because it gives them a sense of pride, right? Like, oh, well, I've been here since day one, episode one. And it's like, okay, well, that's
great.
We're
the real fans. We're more entitled, you know, we're more deserving. Mm-hmm. That it's always so funny that that happens in all like niche areas. It's just funny to watch it in podcasting, right? It's definitely a thing in politics. Yes. You know, I've worked on this many campaigns, or I've put in my time in this way, and therefore I'm deserving of X, you know, whatever it is. And people do it in all spaces. And so I get when it's someone's job that is a little bit more serious. Like, you know, I don't know how I would react if this was my like full-time gig. But, you know.
Sure, sure.
I still think people are a little salty when they don't need to be. And just like.
Oh, yeah.
Like, come on. There's space. There's space for everyone. People, everyone's starting a podcast.
Right. And my thought is like, if you need to dim someone's light to make your shine brighter, that's just like a fundamental problem. You know, the entitlement behind, well, I should get this, or I've been here since day one. And it's like, there's an entitlement to that, that it's like, there's room for all of us at the table. And that shouldn't, like, there are tons of therapists on Bravo. By the way, I follow all of them. I love them. I don't care how big their accounts are. There's room for all of us at the table. Mm-hmm. But that is not a mindset and an approach held by all. Some people have a very cutthroat, it's you or me kind of mentality. And that's, you know, sad. And but I'm just glad that we're not like that.
I know. I think it must be exhausting. I always think about people in the workplace who view everything as a zero sum game. Therefore, like if I win, you lose. And if you win, I lose. And I just think that must be exhausting because I can't imagine spending that much energy on everything where I'm frustrated all the time. Right. Because anytime someone else wins, that somehow is a loss for you. You know, that's
right. And imagine how you would behave if that was your approach to life, right? So it's like some of these
I encounter a lot of those people in Washington, D.C.
Oh, honey, I bet you do.
There's so many interesting personalities. That's why, like, I'm not as fazed by some of the behavior on Bravo, because I'm like, the audacity. And then I'm like, there's plenty of people here who like that kind of stuff, or who behave in just such bizarre, unusual ways. Or, you know, like, I think a perfect example is watching Larsa deny having work done on her body. And then,
oh my God,
the people, you know, deny having ever tweeted what they tweeted, or deny not ever supporting Donald Trump. And then now they do. Like, you know, denying that the sky is blue. Like, people will deny whatever they have to deny if it fits their narrative and if it gets them what they want. So
that's right. And furthermore, if they're surrounded by echo chambers, right, that is how these characteristics turn into personality constructs that then become problematic, right? Because if that's your mindset and you're in an echo chamber and no one's challenging you and being like, I think you need to look at this, that is how underlying personality stuff truly is formed.
So I mentioned this on the Dumpster Dive podcast, but I was saying how, and I don't understand everything about brain scans or what part of the brain lights up from like language versus memory versus whatever. But I do know that experiences shape like neural pathways. And a huge thing I'm interested in is when people, what their pathways are in their brain before they become famous, and then 10 years later when they're now just surrounded by yes people, everything is doable, easy, they get what they want when they want it. And, you know, what does that do to someone's brain, and how does that change their behavior? And a big question I've always had is Tom Sandoval. Like, we know he's capable of this kind of stuff because he did it to Kristen, right? He, like, couldn't break up with Kristen. So he just did this, like, long, slow decline of the relationship. Oh, yeah. And then there was overlap with Ariana. But the audacity of what he did with Ariana by, like, getting with Rachel, also on the show, thinking he could keep it off of the camera, that it would all go his way. Would he have done that prior to being on Vanderpump Rules? Or did he, like, was his brain literally, did it change over the last decade that they've been famous, so that he actually truly thinks he can get away with things because he has for so long? I don't know the
answer.
That
is such a good question. You know the answer?
No, I don't know the answer. I just am curious. Oh, okay. Like, I don't know if we can ever find out, but I'm like, another example is like, kids who become famous, like, or people who become famous very young, like Justin Bieber. You know, what was he like when he was 11 versus at 25? And like, how does that make him more likely to get in bad situations where he could abuse drugs or alcohol, where maybe if his pathway had been different, he wouldn't have, that wouldn't have happened. So I guess going back to the Tom Sandoval of it all, That's what I kind of want here. Like, how much do you think the show plays into like people's brains tricking them into thinking they're more important than they are, they can get away with more, you know, whatever it is?
Mm-hmm. It's such a good, again, good question and insightful thing, because I also happen to be like, I'm a full blown psychology nerd. I love cognitive, like the, you know, neuropsychology and all those different things. And I read a study the other day that showed, and this is going to blow your mind, at having 10,000 followers on Instagram is enough to change neural pathways in your brain. That's
okay.
It.
This is exactly and my theory.
Yeah. Yeah. So to your point, 10,000, when you look at, you know, okay, well, some of these people have millions and they're on TV and this and that. The answer to your question is absolutely positively. There are neural pathways that will form and change based on the celebrity. And on the other side of that coin, there's also, I believe, when I went on the podcast with Jackie Goldschneider and Jen Fessler, two Jersey Jays, we talked about how I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought. Oh my God.
You were talking about the neural pathways, and if you have 10,000 followers, and it could actually change the neural pathways. And then you went on two Jersey Jays.
So, yeah. And listen, this is truly, I don't even need you to edit this out, because this is just like when you, I've gone through chemotherapy and immunotherapy, my brain is just like, sometimes it feels like a sieve.
No, after I had COVID the first time, my brain, like I had a lot of recall issues. It didn't last very long, but like words I would have trouble remembering. It was like I had, I could describe what the word meant, but finding the word was hard.
Right, right. And I do like to use a lot of like my whoopsie moments as just like to normalize and humanize and to let people know, because people look at me like I'm amazing and I'm like, I'm an imperfect person that, you know, forgets stuff. So
no, but this is what I've been like wondering, though. Does the amount of attention you get, whether it be Instagram followers, the number of people that watch their show, or the number of people that recognize you at the airport, change your brain? And then does that change in the brain lead to changes in behavior?
Absolutely. And yes, yes, and yes. So the changes in the brain, and we also, the thing is that the question you asked before about certain personality characteristics that go into this in the first place, well, we also can't forget the neural pathways in these folks that have already been formed that then inform their behavior and then lead them to be more likely to be reality stars, right? Because when we grow up with certain traumas, or we all have these neural pathways that are just formed. And those of us who have experienced a lot of trauma, those neural pathways, I kind of joke about them being a factory default setting. So like, for example, if you were going to therapy and you work on things, there may be a trigger for you where your brain will go back to that factory default setting. You'll have this reaction to something that is an old reaction. And then you're like, wait a second, I'm different. Why is this happening? And that is how powerful these neural pathways are. Okay. So when those neural pathways happen, and the answer is yes, it only takes 10,000 Instagram followers, which, by the way, I'm at 9 and I'm terrified. I'm like, am I going to like wake up when I get 10 and be like a monster? Am I going to be like husband, give me my smoothie. Like what will happen to me? But I think that it absolutely then informs the behavior, because what happens is too, it's like, well, when we get used to this attention and adoration, and if that's your only form of self-validation, you need that to survive. And you need, it's like a drug where you need more and more and more of the same thing to get that desired feeling and behavior. So then what ends up happening is then the behaviors get more intense. But also something I want to note that's really important is that I believe in the Bravo world, these atrocious behaviors are incredibly rewarded. I mean, look at Scandoval. They all, got wealthy and products and commercials and look at Ariana, and I'm not saying she doesn't deserve that, but ultimately this was a show that was likely going to be canceled. And now they're in this era of celebrity that 1,000% is going to change their neural pathways. It's going to change their behavior. And if they're in an echo chamber and it's left unchecked, Tom Sandoval is a good example of someone who is just incredulous. He wants attention. He doesn't care how he gets it. He has no interest in gaining insight into his behaviors or taking accountability. He has no interest in it. And the answer to that is because he has been rewarded for this type of behavior. So why on earth would he change it? We only change if we have a reason to do so.
Do you think, though, that this like big backlash to his behavior, because I would argue that he hasn't made money off this. He can't get the Instagram deals he had before. He is kind of persona non grata, like at a lot of places.
Mm.
Do you think that would be enough of an incentive for him to kind of take a deep look at, like, okay, I messed up. Why did I get to this place? Like, why did I trick myself into thinking that I was the victim in the situation, that I deserved a way out, that I, you know, it, yeah.
Anyways. Mm-hmm. So my quick answer to that is, no, I don't believe it's for him will change, because if it was going to change his behavior, it would have.
Yeah.
Because I think so. Some people, back to when I talked about how some people don't care about positive or negative attention, there are some people who are happy to be villains. And I think that if he were going to experience that process, right? Like, I kept having hope for him because truly, as a therapist, I do like to see all sides of people. We all have good and bad parts. All totally. Of us, right?
Yes.
So I like to see the humanity in people. Unless, like, if you have true psychopathology, like if you're a true like psychopath and like you're a really bad person, obviously that's different. But all human beings, I believe, deserve to be happy and have good and bad parts. Now, Tom Sandoval really challenges my fortitude with what I've just said, because he just has given up every opportunity that he's had for growth. And I just think that he doesn't care about being a villain or being like a, you know, being loved or being a villain. He just, the attention is the attention is the attention. That's my personal view on it. Because again, if he would have, he had plentiful opportunities, right, to have some of those moments, and he just hasn't taken them. So I don't know him personally, but that's going to be my guess based on what I know about human nature.
So another person I wanted to ask you about, who I feel like's behavior changes very dramatically, including on this season, is Lala Kent. You know, we've seen her. She comes in as a fighter. She jokes that she's all bark and no bite. You know, she's very tough on the outside, but then on the inside, she is soft. You know, we watch her be so, like, in how she talks, so convincing that she is right in every time she talks about anything. But then when she actually gets a moment to reflect, she'll admit that she's like, that was really shitty of me to do or say, which I find so funny because, like, why speak with such certainty all the time?
Yeah.
Why does she speak with such certainty? Because I feel like there's a reason. I just don't know what it is. Like, that she you know, I don't know, digs her heels in.
So this is my theory.
Braces. Okay.
This is my theory. Right. Because, like, you're so right. And I just did a post about Lala about how, like, here's the thing. I think Lala, fundamentally, I enjoy her as a person, but the contradictory behavior drives some people wild. And I understand it. I think for her, remember we were talking about those neural pathways based on our history of trauma? When Lala reacts that way, which it is hilarious because she does it. It's like, it's watching this ping pong match of her just like talk about something from a place of certainty, knowing she's going to come back to it and be like, my bad.
Right. You know,
but so, yes, I believe when she does that, it is her history of trauma. So when she gets challenged when she feels wounded, when she feels hurt, her factory default setting is ferocious. I'm going to tear your eyeballs out. I'm going to talk about this from a place of passion and certainty because I have to defend myself. She doesn't need to do that anymore. And I don't know if she's done the work or had the therapy to understand that that is a neural pathway. Like it's just her factory default setting. And when she, the real Lala is shown in how she can look back at something and be like, yeah, my bad. I shouldn't have said that. And to me, that is truly all we can do as humans is when we screw up to take ownership. And I think the audience would just like to see her stop taking such a stance and just like be more open and understanding that like maybe she doesn't know it all. But in my opinion, it is a neural pathway factory default setting that it comes from a place of like reacting to her trauma.
I don't know what her trauma is, though, which also makes it harder to, like, other than the Randall stuff. I'm talking about, like, growing up, because she entered the show this way. That was long before Randall came into her life. What I thought was so kind of obnoxious about her, I like her. I really do. I feel the same way about anyone else that writes a book that doesn't really, like a memoir, right? The Give Them Lala story, mm-hmm. when you don't really have a story to tell yet. And you don't know that you don't have a story to tell because you haven't lived enough.
Right.
And I mm-hmm. feel that way about anyone that puts out a book that's basically saying, like, this is my story, and they're 25 or mm-hmm. they're 30, and you haven't had enough. And all the things I'm interested in learning about her happened after mm-hmm. this book came out. Like, her as a mother, her protecting her family, you know, getting out mm-hmm. of this really terrible relationship, like leaning on her right. mom and her brother, like all of that stuff is so fascinating. Mm-hmm. And none of it's in the book. So it's just like, people just wait till you're much older to write, you know, to write a story about your life. Because yes, and she did open up about things in that book and, you know, having an abortion, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think the most interesting aspects of her, you know, live 10 more years and then I'll really want to read it, you know?
No, you're right. And that is such a funny thing. But like, so all I'm going to touch on about that is that everyone who is on reality TV, they have some sort of story that just because like, I don't necessarily know what it is. There's something there more for some than others. Right. But like, Lala's behaviors tell me that she has had to be self-protective. I'm not sure why that is. Like a lot of folks who have that kind of like ferocious, I'm going to claw your eyes out, it really just comes from not knowing how to protect themselves when they're hurt. So where that developed, I don't know. But, you know, yes, to your point, I would have loved a book, you know, maybe talking about some of this, like, where did that come from for you in your childhood? And talking about the Randall stuff, because I did an episode about the Randall scandal. And there, you know, what I think is interesting is like, what made her choose this person and ignore red flags? Like, that also is interesting and tells me maybe a lot about her unknown trauma. Like, there's got to be, you know, there's reasons that she, you know, did the things that she did and stayed so long and all those things. And trust me, this is not to blame. I am a huge advocate.
Oh, no. Yeah.
You know, so just to be really clear about that, but yeah.
Yeah. It's wild. The stories we can tell ourselves to, you know, keep our reality the way we want it. You've talked a bit about Kyle Richards before and why her behavior this season on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills has been so different. And I mm-hmm. think you and I both, I mean, my immediate reaction to like looking at all this was, why aren't they talking about that friend of hers that died? And then they finally started talking about it, which is really nice to see this season because it's clearly had such an impact on her. And it just didn't mm-hmm. make the story, you know, from mm-hmm. last season. But I'm mm-hmm. like, this must be why she's changing her behavior. Do you feel that part of her relationship with Morgan, and I have not said whether like that I think it's romantic, but mm-hmm. is almost like this person has kind of almost not replaced, but sort of her friend Lorene, And like, this is her, she needs mm-hmm. to have like a woman in her life that she mm-hmm. feels like grounded with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, again, super smart and introspective thought. And absolutely, yes. I think that, you know, and going back to Lala for one second, but on the same vein, like Lala has a sobriety journey that just mm-hmm. like all of it was cut out and they didn't even show that. Because sometimes I think on Bravo, what irritates me is that the hard stuff that really makes us human and is like great to show, they don't want it. They don't want, you know, to talk about, you know, the death of Laureen. They don't want to talk about Lala's sobriety. They want Scandoval. They want, you know, Merce in a purse, whatever. Like that's what they want. But with Kyle, I here's what's interesting, because I don't know if the folks listening know. So I posted a clinical interpretation about this and she reposted it and I thought I was going to die. I thought I was like, I could not even imagine that this was like my real life, because it was just a theory. But essentially, they did her a disservice, I think, by not, A, the ladies were not asking the right questions. So people on Housewives get frustrated about like, why aren't you telling us more? And it's like, well, you're asking terrible questions. You're focusing on her ring and like, did Mauricio buy it? It's like, focus on the stuff that matters and you'll get the answers that you're seeking, right? I mean, part of the onus is on them too. So I definitely think that Kyle losing Laureen, I have a friend that I've had since kindergarten. And I truly, if something happened to her, I would not know like what to do. And I do think that Morgan is a replacement in a lot of ways. I think she's a replacement for, you know, Kyle really thrives on having very close, intimate friendships, female friendships, like true, authentic ones, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that Morgan represents freedom, number one, right? Morgan is tattooed. She gives zero fucks. She's like, whatever. Morgan is a breast cancer survivor and Kyle's mom died yes. of breast cancer. And so I think Morgan's journey really just touches something like, you know, in Kyle. But I think it is astute observation that you made that the people are picking up on the oddity of the relationship. And what's frustrating is they're making judgments about whether it's romantic or not. And to me, I don't like that, because it's none of our business. It doesn't matter. But what they're picking up on is valid, which is that Kyle and has kind of clung to Morgan almost like a life preserver in the ocean. Yeah. And so people are like, well, this is weird. And it's like, but this is what she needs to do to survive right now. And who am I to judge what she needs to do to keep herself afloat? Because this situation that happened with her friend could have easily taken her under. Easily.
Yeah.
So I just think it's amazing that she is taking a look at her life. She's taking an assessment of what role does alcohol play, you know, working out and all this other stuff. Do I think she overcorrected and there are some extremes happening? Yes. But at the same time, when somebody's trying to save their own life, as someone who's been in that same position multiple times, no one can judge how we do it, right? Yeah. She's saving her own life. So let's just let her do that, as long as she's not hurting anybody else or herself, you know. But that, you know, that's kind of my thought on it.
Yeah, I think she's gone overboard with the exercise in a way that could be very unhealthy for her. But, you know, maybe that's something that can be dealt with later on, right? Once like the more serious things, not to say that that's not serious, but the thing I've always judged is just Morgan's age and the fact that she has adult daughters and that her daughters, some of them are older than Morgan. And I would find that weird if, you know, like that was what was going on in my life. Like if my dad started hanging out with people that were younger than me, that's just odd to me. I'm like, why are you, you know, doing this?
And listen, that is more than fair. That is more than fair. It is, I will validate, it is kind of odd. It is an overcorrection. And I do agree with you about the exercise, because here's the thing. People think like, Oh, well, exercise is great. But in actually, one of my first research papers that I did in grad school was about exercise addiction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because I've worked in an inpatient residential facility for addiction. And the thing that I've learned about addiction is that whether it's a substance or a process, right, like exercise, food, sex, love, it really all comes from the same stuff. It comes from having pain that you're not wanting to address, and you want to stuff it, and you want to distract, and you want to use these things to feel right. Because exercise, it creates literal endorphins in the brain, and it can make you happy. But I do think it's an overcorrection, and I do think it's extreme. And the danger of that, of course, becomes disordered eating, and you know,
which
inappropriate,
Kyle has
like
openly dealt with. She's talked about it. That's why I'm so concerned.
That's right.
I'm like, this is something you've done before as a coping mechanism.
Sure, sure. And you're right. This is, with her history, something that if she does not have awareness and people around her to challenge it, this really could absolutely go right back to disordered eating and behavior for sure. So yes, that's accurate. And, you know, hopefully she has enough people in her life who are kind of challenging her about that. Because we know, again, the neural pathways, when you have had a history of disordered eating, you can slip right back into that neural pathway. In times of crisis, we go back to what we know. And so you're right. I think she went back to those coping skills that she knew. And it is a little extreme. And that's what people are reacting to.
Yeah. And then finally, the last person is one who is a bit extreme in her behavior, but who I've always really enjoyed, which is Candace Dillard Bassett. So we're seeing her this season, and she is just adamant that she was wronged, which I believe she was, last season by Giselle. Not as much by Robin, but she's looping them in together, and she's not letting go. And it's disruptive. And same with Giselle. Giselle's also not letting go. Right to the things that Candace said to her and the impact it had in terms of people, death threats. I feel like all of them get death threats. There's so many messed up people out there. And if you have, if you're on a show, it's going to happen at some point, which is awful.
Which is just so gross. Like,
it's terrible. What's wrong with people? It's crazy.
It's like, if you are so invested in someone that you are sending them a death threat, get off of social media immediately, run to a therapist and assess your behavior, because that is so, it's bonkers. It's just not acceptable. I know it's so frustrating. And some of the comments that I get, I'm like, would you say this to my face? And then it's like, yeah, they probably would.
The episode that I did with Chelsea, we talked about the online disinhibition effect, which I've been trying to contact. If maybe you would know how to find this guy. The guy who came up with it, it was like in 2004. And I've been trying to, like, I emailed him and I never heard back. And anyways, I think he is in New Jersey. But basically, there's like six principles that kind of make up the online disinhibition effect. And one of them is that you don't look at people in their eye. And when you're not looking at someone in the eye and they're not right in front of you, it's a lot easier to say something that, and it's a lot harder when you're looking at them, right? So I do think people act very differently online, and it brings out, and I believe social media is an addiction for most of us.
Yes. And there is definitely, so I'm going to use Reddit as a great example. And after the show, we'll talk and I'll help you try to get in touch with him. I always say that, like, Reddit, it because it's one of those things that you can be completely anonymous, anonymity breeds the most awful human behavior. And there are concepts of this that even goes to terrible things like the Holocaust and these terrible tragedies, where dehumanizing someone and having a sense of anonymity, it removes you cognitively from the act. And then it allows these egregious things to happen. And so obviously, like, it's different, but I just wanted to use that as an example. So that 1,000% is what happens. But there's also a personality type where they'll say something to you terrible because of the anonymity, and then you'll message them privately about it. Like, I've done that. and they'll still like double down on being terrible. Or sometimes people will be like, you know, I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time, whatever. Like, I actually have those conversations with folks because I want to know, like, are you just a human going through it and we're having a miscommunication, or are you being a troll?
Right.
And their behavior will tell you, right? Like, if mm-hmm. they're having an actual one-on-one conversation with me and they're still dedicated to calling me a this or a that, then I'm like, okay, that's just a part of your personality. But there is a lot of folks that aren't just inherently, they're not inherently bad people. They just, the anonymity, it creates a sense of ick mm-hmm. for sure. But Candace Diller Bassett, I have to like, I just giggle because I adore her, but my God, she is stubborn. You know, it's like, she is so likable, but like you said, her toxic trait, we all have them, is that she just won't let things go. She just won't let it go and move on. And ultimately what happens is Candace is someone who in my mind, she'll have a good point, but then she'll talk herself back out of the good point by her terrible behavior because yeah. she's being stubborn and revengeful and vindictive, right? So I think that's why for me, she's so polarizing because A, she is so talented. I mean, her songs are like really good. Drive Back, that's a bop.
Oh, like, I love it. And she has an MBA. Like, this woman has a head on her shoulders.
Yeah. She's smart. She's talented. She's gorgeous. She has a wonderful personality, but she's young. And I think part of her youth is this stubborn sense of like, I feel like sometimes young folks, they have the stubborn sense of like, well, I know that I'm right. So I'm going to like beat this like a dead horse. And it's like, well, that's just hurting you. So
yes.
I do
yes.
think there's.
Okay, mm-hmm. sorry. I'm like, this is only hurting her, that how much she's holding on to this.
Oh, 1,000%. There's a saying in the program of AA that holding on to anger and resentment is like drinking poison and wanting somebody else to die.
Yep.
And I truly live by that. I'm not in the program of AA, but I was a therapist in a rehab. So I just feel that the concept of holding on to stuff and not letting go, it's not even about Giselle or Robin or whatever. It's just hurting her, and it takes her power away and it makes her look silly when she makes these like really nasty comments. Or, you know, she can read for filth, which I'm like, it is amazing. But then sometimes it gets too, you could tell it like comes from that place of anger and stubbornness, and then it just makes her look like a jerk. And she's better than that. So that frustrates me for her, you know?
Yeah, I really don't like when she said you're dwindling uterus to Giselle, especially knowing what's going on with like her health issues and fibroids. And, you know, that was shitty. Or like your white looking ass, you know, it's... And bringing in all the colorism stuff, which I understand they wanted to talk through. But that also, I think, is what led to some of the death threats, is people are very, very angry about the issue of colorism and how it's handled or not handled or perceived to be handled on the show. And to like these, like no one needs to compare these women who are all black or mixed race to white people. Like that's not a... I don't know. She did that in a way that I thought was really nasty.
Yes. And to your point, I think that's the perfect example of what I'm saying, where they were having this beautiful talk about colorism, right? Mm-hmm. It was productive. It was helpful. It was educational. I appreciated it. And then she allowed her anger for Giselle and Robin to make that comment, which completely walked back every goodwill and good thing that had come from this discussion. She just shot herself in the foot in a spectacularly disgusting way. And I will say, so I lost my ability to have children after having ovarian cancer. And so for me, I'm sensitive to that stuff too. And I just think what she said about the uterus, was just like really triggering, really shitty. And she's better than that. But she... You know, she makes herself go real low, and that makes her unlikable, and that makes people be angry with her. And she has nobody to blame but herself with that.
Yeah.
And those are two very good examples of that. So listen, all I can hope for her is that, you know, what I wish she could do right now is to say, for with colorism thing, to say, for example, like, okay, you know what? I said that out of anger. I apologize. I shouldn't have said that. But like, she gets so stubborn in being right that she makes herself look terrible.
And she may have had a really good point. Like, what I think she was trying to say is, because you are light skinned, you can get away with more from the audience of this show than I can. You can accuse my husband of acting inappropriately. You can make innuendos and kind of make it seem as if maybe he was interested in assaulting you or interested in hooking up with you. Like, and you could then be like, well, I didn't mean that. I, you know, and because of how you look, the audience doesn't hold you accountable. But when I mess up, they hold me accountable. And I have a feeling it might have to do with the pigment of my skin and how dark it is versus how light yours is. That is a reasonable thing to say. We don't know. We don't know why the audience behaves how they behave. I do believe there is an element of, like, when women have lighter skin, if they're black and have lighter skin, there is, like, kinder reception. I feel like that's been proven. And but she could phrase it differently, you know, and the way that
imagine.
Yeah. As if it's Giselle's fault, you know, that she has the skin color she does. Yeah.
Right. Like, imagine if Candace would have said, you know, I feel hurt because I feel, due to the color of my skin, I get treated differently than you. Imagine if she would have said that. There could have been a real conversation, or her needs or her validation could have been met, whereas she took out a bazooka and just, like, shot her in the chest and just, like, alienated people in the process, where I feel like it came from a place of hurt. And again, she may have she may have had the point, but then it's like the way she goes about it. Because you're right. I mean, colorism is absolutely very real. People, you know, I'm mindful about how I talk about it as a white woman, but it's a very real. It's, again, they had talked about it. And so she is essentially doing the thing that she is frustrated that other people are doing, right? Like, she's using that kind of colorism towards Giselle. And it's like, well, but then you just made yourself part of the problem, instead of being part of the solution or part of, like, talking about it. So, yeah, that was bad.
Yeah, so those were the main people I had. But I guess I'm going to add one more and then we can wrap up, which is Robin Dixon and how she is with her relationship with Juan. She's said that they're not in therapy, that their problems are actually with the rest of the world and not with each other. And everyone seems to think that she's got her head in the sand and that she's purposefully in denial, or maybe she knows and just doesn't want to talk about it on camera. What do you make of her and her way of kind of navigating the world in the relationship that she's in?
Oh, boy. Okay. I've posted so much about this.
Okay.
I need because I have so many feelings about this. And it's funny, I have one post about that I did about this, that it must have gotten in some sort of algorithm, because it, like, people, it's like 2 weeks old and I still have people commenting on it daily. And it's a post about Robin and Juan. So my thing with Robin is, I believe that she is self-neglectful. What does that mean? Self-neglectful is when we are numb and will not attend to our own feelings and needs. And there's a bunch of reasons why this happens, okay? But I am so beyond disgusted with Juan's treatment of her. But I'm also frustrated with her lack of willingness to address it. And, like, I do believe she does have her head in the sand. I fully believe to be continually in this relationship, to make it, quote unquote work. You would have to have your head in the sand to continue to maintain it. Because the way that he has spoken to her, I just posted and I'm like, if people speak to you like this, they're not, run away, please, because that is not acceptable. Like, that is not love. Speaking to people the way that he speaks to people is just absolutely unacceptable. Number one. Number two, the one insight that I had is that Robin and Juan have been together. They've literally grown up together.
Yeah.
There is a kinship and a bond that can only be explained. So, for example, I've been with my husband since I was 20. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm 43.
Wow.
When you are with someone for multiple decades, literally we've grown up together. We went to college together and, you know, we've built this life together and we're so happy because we both do the work. Like, long-term, decades-long relationships, they don't just magically, they're not just magically great. Both parties have to be equally committed to both personal work and development and couples work and development. And Juan just isn't there. I mean, clearly, he's made that very clear. I'm not guessing. I'm not judging. I'm telling you based on what he has said and what he has shown us. He is not in that space. So what are Robin's choices? To dig your head in the sand and to just say, well, for myself and my kids, and I love this man because I do think that there's real, true, deep love there. I'm going to stay, but I don't think she's happy. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, if he's not willing to change, she only has two options. Her two options are for her to change and take a step back or to just accept what's happening. And I don't judge the fact that she's choosing to just accept what's happening because divorce is scary and they were already divorced once before, right? I'm sure it's like, it's pride, but also like she just loves this man and they have children together. So it's so complex. But ultimately, I think that she is self-neglecting and you can see that she's not happy. And that makes me very sad for all of them because I think they just all deserve better.
Yeah, me too. I do feel bad for Robin in this situation. And I think she, the viewers of the show and the other women on the show and these things coming up has made her like have to look at them. Even though she has her head in the sand, and I think she's resentful to everyone that makes her look at the reality.
1,000%, because remember I talked about echo chambers. So the thing is that when we have people check us, we don't like that. Yeah. I'm going to be honest. I love personal growth. I love looking at my stuff. I love taking accountability. But sometimes when my husband is like, hey, what about this? I'm like, fuck you.
Right? Yeah.
So it's like, it's my point is that it's hard to look at your stuff and it's hard to have these women. It's hard to hear things you don't want to hear. I don't blame her. It must be overwhelming. It's so frustrating. Like, would it just be easier for her if they were just like echo chambers of, yeah, you know, you guys are great. And who cares if he's cheating and who cares if he's doing all these crazy things? Like, a good friend isn't going to say that. And truly, this whole process has also made me appreciate Giselle a lot more because for better or worse, Giselle is a friend to Robin. She's a friend in that she's going to be like, mm-mm. You know, she's going to call Juan on his behavior. She's going to say the things that her friend needs to hear. But it also is understandable that Robin is frustrated about it. I get it. It's hard to hear.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. There's so many. We could just go on and on. But like, I really appreciate you being here, kind of going into, you know, answering all my questions, especially about the neural pathways. I'm fascinated by that. And just thank you for taking the time and sharing your knowledge with us. Tell everyone where they can find you, where they can listen to your podcast, anything else you want to plug or talk about.
Thank you. You're so sweet. Yeah, we could do this for like 4 more hours.
I know.
So it's been a great conversation. Thank you for your thoughtful approach. I do really appreciate that. So you can find me. Please go over to Instagram. So my neural pathways can be forever changed. You know, I can hit 10,000 followers.
I love that.
So I am on Instagram, Your Bish Therapist, and it's spelled YourBish Therapist. So I'm Your Bish Therapist on Instagram. I am also have a YouTube channel. So my podcast, you can find it anywhere you listen to podcasts, Apple, Spotify, etc. And by the way, I will announce season two premiere of my podcast is going to be on Tuesday.
Well, this is coming out after that, but it will be within a week of that.
Okay, perfect. So those who are listening, the episode is out. Please go listen. And for people, so I, as you can see, like in this video, I make a lot of like wild hand gestures and facial expressions. So my podcast is the audio, and then I do the audio and the video. I release that to YouTube. So you can go to Your Bish Therapist YouTube channel and look at that. And what I would just ask is, please, if you listen to the podcast and enjoy it, please head over and give me a 5-star review. I would greatly appreciate it. After I talked about, I'm not going to say who, but some of the folks that we mentioned here, I got trolled by fans. Spammed with, So I got spammed with one-star reviews.
They're fans of Tom Sandoval? I'm just kidding.
No.
I'm kidding.
It wasn't him. Yeah, I don't think he has any fans. Although he clearly does. I mean, he has a new girlfriend that I'm like, have you paid attention? Like, what are you doing?
It's always interesting, right? Anyway. Like those guys, you know, who are in prison for murder and they have like all these women writing them. You know, it's not to compare.
We could do a whole other episode on that.
Murder, but you know. Just
no, literally. I mean, it's very similar, and we could do a whole other episode on that. That's actually a super good idea. So yes, anyway, please, you know, if you would be so kind, 5-star review and, you know, all that stuff. And I just, you know, Mandy, I've appreciated, you know, just this conversation and your insight and awareness and professionalism. And so, you know, I look forward to working together in the future. I'm
yes.
loving to have you on my podcast.
Oh,
and, you know,
that.
I just think we need to have some more combos because I think this was really great.
Oh, thank you so much, Melissa. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome.